About 5 years ago, I walked in one Hoshana Rabbah night and I decided, with a certain amount of preparation, of course, that during Yom Tov, we invite in Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Hosha, Aaron, Yosef, David, we invite them into our sukkah. And I had this feeling that when they enter the sukkah, there's something that they want to say to us. They don't just come into the sukkah. They may want to advise us, admonish us. They may have something significant and important to say about the state of the Jewish people. And that's what it has developed into during the course of the last 4 years. That the sheer, there are some who may use the ugly word and say that the sheer is politics, but of course we here reject that completely out of hand, because whatever the situation in Eretz Yisrael is, for us it's pikuach nefesh, it's not politics. For 11 years we've been living through an extremely difficult period of time, and certainly the course of the last 4 years. We're now going into the fifth year of, I don't know what war you want to call it, Milchemet Yom HaDin. It started on Rosh Hashanah 4 years ago. We're into the fifth year. And I remember when I came to the first year, I was extremely upset because there were a number of Mitaylim, hikers, who were pinned down on Har Eival that afternoon. And Israeli helicopters were hovering overhead, and for the life of me, I don't understand what they hovering overhead. Go in and shoot! Do something! I remember I came home that night, 11 o'clock, I'm listening to the news, and I find out that a Jew that I had met only a few days earlier, 4 days earlier in the sukkah of Rav Avram Shapiro, Solangiyavim, Jew by the name of Rav Binyamin Herling, great Talmud Chacham, great Tzaddik, made a profound impression on me, had been killed late that afternoon on Har Eival. And I'm not so certain that we have fully learned anything from the course of the last 4 years. I don't know, I just wonder, every time Sahal goes in again, when we thought that the last time they went in, they finished up the whole job. Everything was done. There's nothing to worry about. There are still tunnels. There are still rockets. There are all sorts of problems that are simply remain unresolved. So it may be a painful evening. But every painful evening, there also has to be something, I would say, joyous about it. They tell me that there, the couple here, by the name of Dr. and Mrs. Benjamin Goodnick from Philadelphia, who've come here to celebrate their 65th wedding anniversary. It's true.
Get up.
Sometimes you have very strange experiences. This go off?
Yeah.
All right, sometimes you have strange experiences. Oh, he's working over there. Okay. Yesterday in the morning, I'm minding my own business. I'm sitting in the sukkah, I'm finishing breakfast, and I'm reading the Jerusalem Post, because the halacha is that you're supposed to conduct yourself in the sukkah the way you conduct yourself in Yom. Now, with breakfast, always comes the Jerusalem Post. That's what you do in the house, and that's what you have to do in the sukkah. So it was absolutely the fulfillment of a mitzvah. I don't know why I see people smiling and even laughing. So here it is. I'm reading the lead article on the front page. But, you know, I can't waste time. I have too much going on. So while I'm having my coffee and I'm reading the Jerusalem Post, I'm listening to the radio. That's three things at one time, and if I could chew gum at the same time, it would really be a major accomplishment. So here it is, I'm reading that the commander-in-chief of Israeli forces has said that the incursion into Gaza has been a great success. That was the headline, great success. And at the same time, I listen to the radio and they say, two rockets just fell on Sderot. And I'm wondering to myself, what kind of a mad world are we living in? What kind of a mad world? And we're living in a mad world that is always lecturing us about morality. I mean, every time the foreign minister of Great Britain says something, it's the last straw. But I said, he's the one who's lecturing us about not going in for targeted killings. Is he mad? Is he stark raving mad? England and the United States, I feel bad for the English. England and the United States went to war against Iraq to target and kill people who are enslaving the people. And he tells us we have to stop targeting terrorists. Now, we can't target terrorists, and we have to be concerned about civilian, casualties. So I want to talk about a number of these ideas that we're sort of being lectured about, and we're being told how to conduct ourselves. So first of all, we have to understand our Gedolei Yisrael were concerned too, and we're going to talk about the Mishpizim, Avraham Avinu, after his great struggle against the four kings, and he brings back the hostages, you understand? Avraham Avinu is not going to tolerate that his nephew Lot and others are going to be held captive and held hostage. He goes to war in order to bring them back home. And then after it's all over, it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to him and says to him, Al Tidar, Avraham, don't be afraid. What is it that he's afraid of? We weren't told that he's afraid. What's he afraid of? He's just come back victorious, but an unbelievable victory. He and 318 of his men have vanquished the four superpowers of the day. And he's concerned. Rashi says, Oh, Amakom, God said to him, Al Tito Avram, don't be afraid, Avram, Anochi Mogen Lach. I'm going to protect you. Min ha'onesh, from any kind of punishment. Shalote onesh, that you will not be punished. Al kol otam nefashot shahraka, for all of those who you killed. Avraham Avinu knew that he was right. He did what he knew he had to do, and he was troubled. There were people who were killed. There may even have been innocent civilians. It does not in any way stop him from doing what he has to do. But the sense of, well, there was a failure here. There were things that had to be done that we don't want to do, but we have to do them. And then, of course, there's the famous passage when Yaakov sees that Esav is coming toward him with 400 men. So it says, "Vayidor Yaakov miyod vayetzelo." Yaakov was very frightened and he was distressed. And Rashi says, "What's the frightened and what's the distressed?" The frightened is lest he be killed, and the distress is that he may have to kill others. Let nobody lecture us about that morality. And here, the Rashi there is very beautiful. Vayidor Yaakov miyod vayetzer. Vayidor, Rashi says, Shemo yehoreg, lest he be killed. Vayetzer, lo, he was oppressed and distressed. Im yaru, hu et achein, if he kills others. And the Sifse Chachamim, Perush on Rashi, makes it so clear. It's on a lama what it means, pen yarog ho'anoshim shevo in Esav. He was concerned, not about whether he'll kill Esav, Esav is no problem. Esav is targeted because Esav is the one who wants to kill him. That's not the problem. The problem is he was concerned, Penyaro Parnoshim, lest he kill the people, Shevo in Esav, Vehenglo Bo Largo, those who came with Esav, but they didn't come to kill him. So that is what distresses him. Does it stop him from preparing for war? No, it doesn't stop him from preparing for war. Nobody likes war. We don't want war. I'm always personally distressed when the so-called camp, the peace camp in this country, accuses us of being the great warmongers. They're telling us, as little children, we knew these Rashis. From childhood on, we had this sense of morality. Nobody has to teach us this kind of morality. But you know what? There was another morality. And that morality may be the overriding one. That what comes first in Torah is the defense and the protection of the Jewish people. And that's where they may have lost out, but we haven't. The first thing that Avraham Avinu does when he comes into Eretz Yisrael, there's the first place he goes to. God tells him, Lech l'chom v'yaretz l'chom v'yolad l'chom v'beit avicha el ha'oretz asher areka. It says, Vayelech Avram, and Avram went, he left Ur of the Chaldees, and he comes to the land of Canaan, and it says that he went through the land at Bekom Shechem. The first place he arrives at is Shechem. And Rashi says, Lehitpalel al b'nei Yaakov, to pray for the children of Yaakov, kishayavou lihilachem b'Shechem, when they're going to come wage war against Shechem. Rashi obviously is making it quite clear that the struggle against Shechem, yes, Shimon and Levi, who come in and massacre the city of Shechem, this was justified, completely and totally justified. The Rambam says, the entire city were mishatfei pu'ula, they were collaborators with Hamor and Shechem. And above all, the most important thing is, with all of the negotiations that were going on, they're holding a hostage. They're holding Dina hostage. That's totally unacceptable. You can't hold Jews hostage. It's 4,000 years later. How many hostages are they holding in Iraq? This is an intolerable situation. People are going to teach religious Jews morality? When there was a statement of rabbis about 3-4 weeks ago that you can't take into consideration the possibility that innocent civilians are going to be killed when it becomes necessary to wage war against terrorists who not only want to kill, but do kill us. And there was an outcry from the left. What are you talking about? They're the ones who are concerned about morality, but we religious Jews, Torah Jews, we're a bunch of bloodthirsty, right-wing extremist killers. Nonsense. We have learned Torah morality from childhood on. This is all part of our basic experiences. Nobody wants to shed blood. But there's one value that's greater than it. And that value is the defense and protection of the Jewish people, wherever they may be. And I'm afraid to say, I'm afraid to say that our government may not have been doing such a great job. As I indicated at the beginning, every time they go into Gaza again, when we thought that they had already cleaned the place up, starts all over again. They'll go out in a few days and they'll have to go back in a few weeks. It's unbelievable. I have in the past said that one of my daily aggravating experiences of the Jerusalem Post is not Beit Haaretz. That's the... There is where I bring upon myself my own punishment every morning. Today I was in Tel Aviv, so I didn't I was hoping, you know, that nobody stole my Jerusalem Post and Haaretz from my mailbox. I came back home in the late afternoon. You know, I shouldn't have worried. I don't think anybody in Haranov wants my Haaretz or my Jerusalem Post. So here I have, I brought my Haaretz. I read an article, and I don't know what world I live in. I just don't know what world I'm living in. Here is their, Yoel Marcus is their great writer. I'll give you the gist of his article. He doesn't understand. Every time that there's a window of opportunity for peace with the Palestinians, they go ahead and they mess it up. Right after Oslo I was signed and passed, buses started blowing up. You remember 95? End of 94, 95, buses were blowing up all over the place. We just signed an agreement with you. We just signed an agreement. Here's the great window of opportunity. Camp David, they nearly got 98% of Eretz Yisrael and half of Yerushalayim, and they can have the earth on Har HaBayit, but we retain the bottom half of Har HaBayit, which of course they haven't kept because they keep digging out the bottom half of Har HaBayit. And here it is, we're just the moment, we're right at a great opportunity, and that was 4 years ago, with a whole burst of new struggle and battle begins. The Prime Minister has decided on disengagement. He has decided to exile Jews from their homes in Eretz Yisrael. Great step. Window of opportunity opens up, and all of a sudden the violence in Gaza, what we've been experiencing the last few months, didn't happen for 11 years. He says he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand. I understood a long time ago. Every time a window of opportunity opens, I catch a cold. The man asks the question seriously. You know what he hasn't? You know what he hasn't understood yet? They don't want land. They want us. They want us. They don't want a piece of land. They want everything. There's a fascinating Gemara in the Sefta Chulin where the Gemara says, here is this nocturnal struggle that's taking place between Yaakov and the angel. Yaakov has crossed to the other side of the Yabok in order to pick up some things that he had left behind, and somebody begins a struggle with him, and they're locked. They're locked in battle. Sometime in the middle of the night, the Gemara says that he turned to his assailant, who is not winning the battle. He turns to his assailant because something's bothering him. What's bothering Yaakov, it's in the middle of another night, but it begins to dawn on him that there's something wrong. What's wrong? He went back to the other side of the river because he left a few altered jars over there. Hey, Shabbatis. And this man is struggling with him for hours over these little jars. You know what any decent, respected Ganif would do? If you can't steal these little jars, you go find somebody else and steal his jars. And maybe you'll even find something better to steal. And this guy's struggling with him during the course of the night. All of a sudden, it dawns on Yaakov and he says to him, "V'chiganevata o kubiustusata? Are you a thief or are you a murderer?" All of a sudden it occurs to Yaakov, the struggle isn't over those jars. The struggle is for Yaakov's life. How can a man, an intelligent man, 11 years into an Oslo struggle, ask the question, what's wrong with them? Why do they explode into a paroxysm of terrorism every time there's another opportunity? He doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. And that's the problem in this country, and I don't know why it is so. They just don't get it. We're not up against an enemy who wants this much land or that much land. They want everything. They want us. You read that article in the Jerusalem Post last week. What's the hottest video in Gaza? The video of the beheadings in Iraq. You understand? Anybody who reads that has to think, oh boy, would they love to have thousands of videos of doing that to us. They don't get it. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It staggers the imagination. Intelligent people just don't get what the struggle is all about. And therefore they don't understand that we're as concerned as anybody else about civilian casualties. Nobody has to teach us anything about that. Nobody has to tell us whether to target people who the rest of the world is targeting. A whole world is looking for Bin Laden. They were all looking for, what was his name again, that fellow, Saddam Hussein? Yeah? The whole world was looking for them. I mean, all points bulk throughout the world. And we can't do this. This is unacceptable. So that Avraham Avinu would have a great deal to say to us. Yaakov would have a great deal to say to us. They would say to us that, listen, nobody has to teach us morality. Nobody has to teach us, if Chazal said that Klal Yisrael are Rachmonim, we are a merciful people. And there are times I get the feeling that we may be a little bit too merciful to our great disadvantage, because we didn't want to hurt civilians. I don't know how many Israeli soldiers died because of that nonsense. How many died because we didn't want to hurt civilians? Doesn't make a difference to the enemy. And they're teaching us. They're teaching us. Now, I don't remember, I think it was yesterday, today, one of the letters to the editor in the Jerusalem Post raises the scepter again of the specter of Amalek. You know how Torah is so cruel, and you know we're people of revenge. Remember the Time magazine used to say this every time there was some kind of a raid by Israel: Old Testament justice of an eye for an eye. So here I want to make one distinction that may assist you very much in understanding what Torah is all about. There are two words that are confused by people. People seem to confuse them. They don't know to differentiate between the two of them. One of them is revenge, and the other is retaliation. If you hit me, and I hit your little boy, that's revenge. If you hit me and I hit you back, that's retaliation. Retaliation is when I go to the source, the one who is causing the trouble, and I struggle with him. That is retaliation, and retaliation is absolutely justified morally and religiously and in every way possible. Never ever let anybody confuse you, and you're simply not going to be able to tell whether we're talking about revenge or retaliation. Targeted killings are retaliation. They're the walking time bombs. Big difference between doing that. In other words, if we target their killers, that's retaliation. That's self-defense. When they target our citizens on buses and in cafes, oh, what? That's murder. That's cold-blooded murder. And we're living through all of this, and I don't think that we have yet. I think there's still a lot of people who really just don't get the whole story. I'm not sure which Spieser is it today?
David?
All right, I don't want to talk about David. No, sorry. I want to talk about Moshe. He's really the one that I've chosen this time to talk about. So I'll have to do it quickly because I've already said a great deal. Moshe Rabbeinu. So of course, if Moshe comes into the sukkah, he's certainly going to remind us of a halacha in Torah. There's a halacha in the Torah that says, "Bova machteret," somebody comes stealthily into my house to steal, he forfeits his life. I have the right to kill him. Kal v'chomer, no question about it. If it's a terrorist who comes to sow death and destruction, of course there's no question about it that I have the right to kill him. It's summed up by the Gemara in one sentence. Habol horgecha, somebody's coming to kill you. Hashkein v'horgo, get up and kill him. There is no morality by any people on the face of this earth, as has happened over here, about taking the first blow, so that the world doesn't think we're a warring people. We take the first blow. It never made any difference to the world anyway. They're not going to be our friends. They've been our friends, really, or admirers, very begrudging admirers, at the end of the Six-Day War, and most probably Entebbe. Those are the two moments in 56 years where we were, so to speak, for a very brief period of time, the darlings of the world. We're not going to win any popularity contest in this world unless we're strong and we're successful. Strength is what they understand. And we have been conducting ourselves from the point of view of weakness for years now. We just can't wait to divest ourselves and give what we have to others. I've been, a friend of mine in New York sent me four books, by Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis, if you don't know, Bernard Lewis is the Goyim of Islam in the world today. I don't know how many books he's written about Islam. I would say it should be required reading for all of our politicians. I mean, he describes what's happening in the world, and he goes back to the very roots of Islam. He describes what's happening in the world, that this is not a localized struggle, what's going on over here. It may very well be that what happens here, as Israel goes, so the rest of the world will go. But there's no question about it that the clash here, Iraq, these are the two places in the world where there's a major clash. It's not a clash. It's not for land. It's not for property. It's a struggle of cultures. And there is a culture called Islam that once war. That culture, they once were the mighty world power. The 8th, the 9th, the 10th, the 11th, the 12th century. When Saladin, you understand, threw the infidels out of Jerusalem. Richard the Lionheart, I guess, Nishkan Lion, and Nishkan Lionheart, what the Mabes do often over here, and it was the great victory of Islam. There's been a slumbering and sleeping giant that all of a sudden, or maybe over about 20, 30 years, has begun to rise again. It's not a localized struggle. Not a localized struggle. This is a world struggle. But there was one thing in the four books. There are a lot of things I can point out, but I just want to point out one idea that he expresses. That's I don't know what to say with it. It's funny, it's strange. He goes through the names of all of the Islamic countries in the Middle East. He points out, except for Egypt, all of them received their names from colonial powers. The French, Algeria, the Italians made Libya, the French and the English, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, all of them are names that are simply not part of Islam. Palestine comes from the Romans. Then he writes the following. Page 63. Ahmed Aleph, let's see. 63. Schreibt Bernard Lewis. The pre-classical names have almost all disappeared. Now, the names that these countries had many, many years ago all disappeared. All the names now are new names. There's only one exception. Israel, which alone is known by the same name, in the same language, the same boundaries as in antiquity. They've been trying to tell us, and so has our left been trying to tell us, that we're the interlopers. We're the ones that are not indigenous to the Middle East. We are the net azar, the strange sapling that has been planted here. When it turns out, we're the only natural ones in the entire Middle East. Even Egypt, that has its name from ancient times, but modern Egypt has no relationship whatsoever, either in religion, in culture, or language to ancient Egypt. What they've all been doing over the years is they are trying to create a history that goes back through the millennia, only in order to establish that they are indigenous to this area. A classic example is when the Shah was still in power, he celebrated a whole year. Was a celebration of 2,500 years since Cyrus, Koresh. And saying Koresh had absolutely nothing to do with the Shah. There was no Islam in the world. Koresh was even our biggest Zohar and idolater. So what was the point of Islam, who would, if there would be a Koresh today, understand they'd kill him, they'd burn at the stake. But what they wanted to do was, they wanted to show that they have roots here. Their roots go back a long time. Just like the Palestinians claim that they come from the Hittites or the Jebusites, the Yevusis. It's all a lie. The only people, same name. And by the way, that's fascinating. Because I understand that there were all sorts of possible names for the state of Israel, and nobody knew what name was going to be given until it was announced by Ben Gurion. I think there were those who wanted to be called Judea, those who wanted the name Zion, and it must have been Min Hashemayim, that the Rebbeinu Shem put it into his head to call the name of this state Israel, the most appropriate name of all. We speak the same language as they spoke here 3,000 years ago, and for those of us who still keep that same religion, it's the same religion as 3,000 years ago. And the geography is the same as 3,000 years ago. And there isn't a single other country, or people, or race, or religion, or language in the entire Middle East that is indigenous to their land. None. We're the only ones. And go ahead and talk to our people over here, and they'll say, we came. Well, we could count it. Who knows what? Yeah. All right, so now, I'm going to briefly deal with one subject that has always been very, very painful for me, and I have studied this at great length. And I think that while it's very painful to talk about it, but I think we have to look at the problem straight in the face. Moshe. I wanted to talk about Moshe. What would Moshe Rabbeinu tell us as he comes into the sukkah? What would Moshe Rabbeinu tell us? Moshe Rabbeinu would tell us the following. Listen, Chevre. Kinoach. Remember, the first day I went out to see what's happening in the land of Egypt, I saw a guy hitting a Jew. And he wanted to kill him. You know what I did? I got up there and I killed that guy. And I buried him in the sand. Straightforward. There is no other way. A Jew's life is in danger. You do whatever has to be done. But Kindler, I have to tell you the truth. I went out on the second day. And do you know what happened when I went out on the second day? I saw two Jews locked in struggle with one another. Two Jews locked in struggle. Now, we all learn Chumash. We know who the two Jews were. Dothan v'Aviram, Dathan and Aviram. Now, we always have this, we have this strange idea, and I want to disabuse you of that idea. We have the feeling that Dothan v'Aviram, as Rashi and the Medrash say in a number of places, they're the ones who left over from the Mon. They're the ones who said to Moshe, Nitna Rosh v'Noshuva Mitzrayma, let's appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt. They were the ones who joined Korah in the rebellion against Moshe. So we get this feeling that Dathan and Aviram are two symbiotic brothers, you understand? Mutton Jeff. Paris and Berlin. there must be others. Who are the other comedy? Aaron and Costello. Those are the guys. Aaron and Costello. Aaron and Costello. The new generation knows how he doesn't even know about Aaron and Costello. Let's face it. What do they know? And we get this feeling about Dathan and Aviram. These are two peas in a pod. They understand each other. And you know what the Medrash tells us about that first struggle? The Medrash says it was a fight to the death. The two brothers are locked in a struggle to the death. When Moshe Rabbeinu breaks up that fight, he's saving certainly one life and maybe two lives. And then one of them, or maybe both of them, goes ahead and he tells Paro, Moshe killed the Egyptian. And there Rashi points out, Ochein noda hadavar, now I know why Jews suffer. Because if there are people who betray their own to the nations of the world, that's the worst. So now I know why they're suffering. Know where that why they're suffering. So you have to know these two people, this Dathan v'Aviram, they see eye to eye only in one thing. In their opposition to religious leadership, they see eye to eye. Otherwise, you put them together in one room, they'll tear each other apart. The suffering of the Jewish people throughout history has been because of the Dathan v'Avirams in our midst. Once gave a shiur here some years ago. You know how many times Dathan v'Aviram are referred to in Torah? No less than seven times they appear. No less than seven times. And these guys make the ugliest statements of all. Can you imagine? It's Shvi Shel Pesach. There's a dark, ominous sea out there. You can hear the hoofbeats of 600 chariots coming toward them. And the Jewish people are caught on the beach. It could be Dunkirk. It could be the end of the Jewish people. And there at the beginning of Parashat Bishalach, can you imagine? Just sometimes we never stop to hear the positive. Why did you take us out of Egypt? Because there aren't enough graves in Egypt, so you took us out into the desert to kill us here. Can you imagine such ugliness? Such ugliness. It's unbelievable. And we read these psukim and go, oh, what do you mean? How can anybody in their right mind say that Moshe and Aaron took the Jewish people out because there wasn't enough space for burial? This is ugly. The ugliest pasuk of all in Torah is the one that's uttered by Dathan v'Aviram. In the struggle of Korach, Moshe Rabbeinu says he wants to speak to Dathan v'Aviram. And they say, Lo na'ale, no, we're not coming. We don't want to talk with you. And he says, they say to him, isn't it enough that you took us out of a land flowing with milk and honey? Do you understand? You longing made for, you didn't bring us to a land flowing with milk and honey. Here's the passage. Hama'at ki ha'elitanu me'edet zavas cholodos. It's not enough that you took us out of the land flowing with milk and honey. Do you know what they've just done? They just called Mitzrayim, with its concentration camps, Eretz Zavas Cholodos. That's ugly. They take a term, a description hallowed by God himself to be used about one land on the face of this earth, Eretz Yisrael. And they say, what? Eretz Zavas Cholodos. Mitzrayim is Eretz Zavas Cholodos. That's so ugly. So ugly. Throughout the seven times they appear in Torah, it's ugly. So I asked the question once, and I pulled at my mother-in-law's question. My mother-in-law, Allah Shalom, you know, somebody would come to the house and say, you know, Yankel said such and such to me. So my mother-in-law would say, let it roll off your back. You can't take everything seriously. I take it so, I said so right. Why does God have to record in Torah the ugliness of Dosan Vavichon? What would our ruchnius be lacking if we wouldn't have that sentence in Torah that they said that Mitzrayim is a land flowing with milk and honey? What would happen if Torah would not have said, repeated, the absolute vicious statement, there aren't enough graves in Egypt that you took us out to destroy us in the desert? It's so terrible. Terrible. What would be wrong for our neshamas if it wouldn't appear in Torah? God, you hurt personally. What? It bothers you. So you have to say it over. And if that would be missing from the Sefer Torah is possible. Sefer Torah possible. Why? Who needed it? Who needed it? So I'll tell you who needed it. And one of the great Hasidic thinkers, the Shem Yishmuel develops the following idea. He says, and he doesn't say it in response to the questions that I asked, but we will be able to answer those questions that I've asked with the words of the Shem Yishmuel. Shem Yishmuel says you should know that every period in history there are going to be Jews who will be Dosan Vavion. We're going to have in every period of history Jews whom we will suffer from possibly more than we suffer from Goyim. And what I'm saying, therefore, that Torah wants to let us know, don't be surprised. Not only don't be surprised, when you see that phenomenon staring you in the eyes, don't try to say, well, they're well-meaning, but they're making a mistake. They're not well-meaning. They're evil. If Shalom Achshav has a full-time person that drives through Yehuda v'Shomron in order to find every last little house that may have been built, or a mirpeset that's closed in, or maybe a sukkah that's up more than 8 days, and reports to the whole world, describe Jews are building in Eretz Yisrael. So you may think, he knows not what he does. No, no, no. These are not people who know not what they do. This is evil. And the evil of Dasan Vavirom appears in the world. And that's why Torah tells us seven times, you're going to come up against this phenomenon. You're going to find Jews that are going to be the worst enemies of the Jewish people. You will find Jews that sit full time in Washington in order to make sure that there's somebody who's telling the sins of the Jewish people to the rest of the world. There will be Jews going through Europe. Don't buy anything that comes from Yehuda v'Shomron. And And therefore, of course, how will people go along with it? Everything's going to be stamped now. If it comes from Yehuda and Shomron, then it's verboten in the world. Do you understand? There's such evil within our own ranks. That's why it's painful for me to talk about it. It's very painful. But you can't simply turn away and say, no, ebesh meh, don't take it so seriously. Torah says you have to take it seriously. The Shem Yishmuel says that, you know where this develops from? It develops as a result of the fact that there are Jews who want to find favor in the eyes of the nations of the world. There are those who want to be looked at as the good Jews. The others, you understand, they're the bad Jews. The seculars, the religious people, all of you, you understand. You're bad, but there are good Jews. And they haven't learned that when, God forbid, a Hitler appears in the world, he's not going to differentiate between one and the other. The Shem Yishmuel says at the end of a long essay, he says, V'nida, he says, Ki hamido ha-mahalechet b'chol ha-koliot, this is something that takes place in all of our exiles. It's a result of the great chutzpah of the nations of the world who curse us. And there are those Jews who become attracted to this attempt at denigrating their own people. And he says, and here is the silver lining to the cloud. He says, as the period of Mashiach comes closer, there will be a larger number of Jews in the world who are going to become enemies of the Jewish people. And he says, you know what? Those Jews are part of the struggle of Gog and Magog. Very difficult stuff, I'm saying. Very difficult stuff. And you know what he says? He says, they are kimodosan v'aviram. Hashem hatov yichaper badam. Let the good God forgive them. V'shavu bonim legvulam. And they should return to the bosom of the Jewish people. V'akol yunich noyel v'teilu l'das Torah. That they should all bend before the knowledge of Torah. In Europe today, and it's been for the last 20 years, there are plays that have been written by Israeli playwrights that are absolutely anti-Semitic, that are playing for great audiences. The Chanoch Levins and the others of this world, of this country, have simply exported Sinat Yisrael out there. So there are two struggles that are going on now in Eretz Yisrael. There's a struggle against the enemy from without, which is an extremely, extremely serious one. But more serious is the struggle that's taking place from within. And the only way that we will ever stand a chance of emerging successful in the battle from our enemies from without, is in the event that we are able to pull ourselves together from within. And our pulling ourselves together from within must take into consideration the fact, you have to know, never to be impressed or swayed in any way by the extreme left in this country. You know what makes me crazy? I was reading today about a poll that was taken. I mean, you can't believe any of the polls. All the polls over here, they're all, somebody asks for a poll and tells them in advance, this is exactly what I want to end up. I'll tell you, I'm here 23 years, nobody ever called me and asked me anything. How many of you here, have any of you been polled about anything in? Did anybody ever get a call from anybody? What's your opinion about something? Oh no, you did? Who? Who?
About banks, about this product.
About this product or that product. Did anybody ask you whether you're for disengagement or against disengagement? For Oslo or against Oslo? For Paris or against? I think it's all a big lie. Second, because I thought that somebody would want to know my opinion in this country. Nobody wants to know it.
They know.
That was a good one. They know. I'll tell you, this is just between us. This shouldn't go out of this room. The Jewish agency in New York wanted a list of speakers to speak about Aliyah in the United States. So my name was on a list of about 45 names. The only response that came back to this organization, to Yerushalayim, is, only thing we have to say about the list, we don't want gold.
No.
You have no idea how proud I am. We have serious, serious problems that are going to have to be dealt with during the course of the months ahead. Oh, but why was I talking about the polls? In this country, like here was a poll, 19% are undecided. I can't for the life of me understand anybody living in this country that doesn't have an opinion about something. And that, of course, is the reason why I don't believe the polls. There's no such thing. Every Jew has an opinion about everything.
Yeah.
We're an opinionated people. We have strong opinions. You're kidding me? They're going to ask a Jew in this country, are you for the disengagement or against the disengagement? And he doesn't have an opinion. What are you talking about? He'll chew your ear off. I think that's why they don't call anybody and they make up the... they make up themselves. Sugar Mary, you're going to call 504 people. The whole country will change by the time you finish it. I believe the most important thing that we have to pray for. I gave a shiur in Tel Aviv someplace this morning for Emuna women. And two members of that group who are here, you understand, I think they're traveling with me around the world. I said that to me now the most important bracha in Shmon Esrei is Atoch Chonein La'odon Das. You grace us, God, with intelligence. We need intelligence. We need to be able to see clearly. We have to be able to understand that we are locked in a struggle for which, regardless of what anybody says, there really is no solution. Now, it may sound terrible when I say there's no solution, but it's infinitely better than thinking there is a solution and coming up with something that is really no solution. It's best to know that we're dealing with an intractable problem that only a Rebbein Shlomo in Himmel is going to save us. And we have to pray to Him, give us intelligence. I have nothing better to say. Of course, if you want to participate in demonstrations, participate, because then it's going to be a very, very difficult, painful year. I'm terrified of the thought of Jews being removed from their homes. God in Himmel, and a tefillah, you understand, Jews removing Jews from their homes in Eretz Israel to give it over to killers, the Chatzavalim. I'm terrified at the thought. So we have to pray, number one, to have intelligence. We have to pray, number two, that no crazy out there is going to upset the balance, because we're at such a difficult crossroad. And the third is a bumper sticker that I tell you is no bumper sticker, but it's the absolute truth. If I'm admitting already all sorts of things, the night in 1996, the night that Benjamin Netanyahu was elected as prime minister, when the early hours of the morning we found out that he was elected, I was elated. I was walking on air for days. And then we were disappointed, to put it mildly. In other words, so at least what he accomplished was that Peres didn't become prime minister. Sharon was elected. I thought, this is it. This is Mashiach's site. Sharon Melech Yisrael. This is going to be it. Or have we been disappointed? Have we been disappointed? There's the bumper sticker that says, Ein lanu amin l'hisha'ein ela avinu shabashamayim. That has to be a Mishnah at the end of the Sefer Sotah. We have nobody to depend on but God Himself. That's God's truth. The fact is, we have no leadership. There's no one we can turn to. We have to pray, and pray with all our might, that the Rebbeinu Shem saves us from what can be a terrible head-on collision between Jew and fellow Jew in this country. It's absolutely terrifying. That's what we have to pray for. Because we have to understand that we're going into what, to me, it seems the most difficult year. All the years that have passed, this is the most difficult one. No one can predict what is going to happen. So we have to pray. And maybe when we do indeed arrive at the moment that we understand Ein lanu amin l'hisha'ein, then God will look down upon us and grant all of us a gemara sina tova, a piska tova. We should be zeicher ta'alichas yamin b'shanim b'riyas haguf b'hanefesh nachas of children and grandchildren. Chag Sameach.